This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is AM. I'm Sabra Lane. The backlash to Scott Morrison's secret appointment of himself to multiple ministerial portfolios isn't waning, even though the former Prime Minister's apologised. Some of his ex-ministerial colleagues are fuming. One's called for him to quit Parliament, but the former Prime Minister, John Howard's, weighed in, saying he doesn't think Mr Morrison should resign. Political reporter Claudia Long has more.
After days of dismay and outrage at Scott Morrison's secret ministerial power grabs, former Prime Minister John Howard says it's time to move on.
Scott Morrison has talked about this, he's contextualised it, and I think everybody, particularly the current Prime Minister, should get on with the present and the future.
And the Liberal Party elder doesn't think Scott Morrison should resign from Parliament for secretly appointing himself to five senior ministries, including Treasury and Home Affairs, without the knowledge of most of his colleagues.
There are reasons why he did it, and part of the Conservative tradition is to always understand the context in which things occur. It's not in the interest of the Liberal Party to have a by-election at the moment.
And while even the country's most senior intelligence operatives were kept in the dark, the current Liberal leader, Peter Dutton, also thinks Scott Morrison should stay put. But constitutional and political experts believe the former PM's ministerial moonlighting has trashed the unwritten rules about how a government is run.
People do need to understand that our system is based on conventions. Those conventions are premised on people exercising self-restraint. And some of the checks and balances are the collectivity of Cabinet.
Public policy expert Professor Anne Tiernan from Griffith University has been concerned by what she's described as Scott Morrison's disregard for traditions and conventions for some time.
This is the risk of winning the miracle election, isn't it? It gives leaders lots and lots of authority and lots of power. But in a collective system, our system's not a presidential system. There do need to be checks and balances.
So is it time for some laws to set in stone the conventions about how a government runs?
It's actually really about the extent to which self-restraint and collective responsibility were real, those important conventions and traditions of our system were operating in the Morrison cabinet, and it seems that they weren't very well.
Dr. Mary Crawford from the Queensland University of Technology also says Scott Morrison has undermined key aspects of our democracy.
Categorically, while he may not have done anything that's illegal, there are consequences for this in terms of democratic conventions. To have a minister appointed whose appointment is held secret distorts any kind of views of transparency or accountability.
And Dr. Crawford says the Governor-General has been put in a tricky position.
He has told us he acted on the advice of the Prime Minister of the day. That's within the system as well. This is what happens when you start breaking conventions. You know, there's a domino effect, and then everybody is operating outside what is generally accepted as practice and part of the process. And that's that process that holds democracy together.
The repercussions from Scott Morrison's secret appointments are not over yet.
In many regional towns and cities, expectant mothers are being forced to drive hundreds of kilometres from their homes to give birth because of a shortage of doctors or midwives. In the central Queensland city of Gladstone, the hospital's maternity unit hasn't been operating for almost 2 months, and as Paul Culliver reports, it's giving new parents some anxious moments.
She wasn't. She's hungry. She's all the time hungry.
Billa Wheeler couple Mariana and Victor are smitten with baby daughter Camille. But her arrival didn't go smoothly. Just before their due date, they temporarily relocated from Billa Wheeler to Gladstone so that they'd be close to the hospital. But when Mariana went into labour one night, their plans fell apart.
They said, no, look, we can't assist during the delivery. There is a bypass. We are not receiving any patients. You need to go to Rockhampton. And I was like, what?
The Gladstone Hospital's maternity unit is on bypass due to a lack of obstetricians and gynaecologists, meaning expectant mums have to go to Rockhampton, just over an hour's drive away.
We try. We said, we tried to go there, but I couldn't handle my pain. So it was unsafe for me to go on road and drive 2 hours with that kind of pain.
Mariana and Victor presented to Gladstone Hospital anyway, But again, they were told to go to Rockhampton.
They just made me feel unsafe. And I felt that my life and my baby's life was in risk.
Finally, they called an ambulance. And after hours of waiting, Mariana was transferred to Rockhampton, where their first child, Camille, was born healthy and safe. Gladstone is home to 60,000 people, and health advocates say locals deserve better.
In our opinion, for the mothers and families of Gladstone, it's unacceptable that they need to travel all the way to Rockhampton to deliver their children.
Dr. Nick Yim is the Vice President of the Queensland branch of the Australian Medical Association.
And it is very, very concerning that 600 deliveries needs to be moved to Rockhampton for delivery. That's not just a round-the-corner trip, that's over an hour drive.
The Central Queensland Hospital and Health Service operates both the Rockhampton and Gladstone hospitals. In a statement, the Executive Director of Gladstone, Monica Seth, says,
"We've been unable to secure qualified locum staff to cover the gaps due to recruitment challenges experienced across Queensland and Australia. Gladstone Hospital staff are communicating with all expectant women to ensure they're aware of the current situation."
Mariana still can't understand it.
How the system can, like, hire, I don't know, good staff or find good doctors.
But despite her experience, she's a very proud and happy new mum.
She's been amazing. She's gaining weight. She's perfect. So she's doing really well.
Bilawelema, Mariana, ending that report from Paul Culliver and Toby Loftus. Regional renters are getting no relief, even as house prices begin to slide. New data shows regional home prices have fallen for the first time since the pandemic began, but rents are still rising. John Daly reports.
Regional house prices are starting to head south, but renters on the streets of Toowoomba in Queensland are still doing it tough.
I think it's really hard at the moment to find housing in Toowoomba. So eventually we got one, but to be honest, it's really hard. Like, we applied nearly 20 houses.
Because they just put my rent up $30 a week. We're not getting paid anymore, so we're forking out more. It's just more out of my pocket every fortnight.
I just moved and the rent was going up by $75 a week at my previous place with no warning.
Was it easy to find another place or?
No, it took about 2 months. We actually had to extend the lease by 3 months. And yeah, it was a whole ordeal.
Like other regional centres, Toowoomba's housing market has been in a frenzy since the pandemic began, leaving a very low rental vacancy of 0.4%. Toowoomba councillor Megan O'Hara Sullivan says that's having consequences.
When you hear about families living in cars, but more particularly that the greatest rate of homelessness is for women over 55, that's scary.
Those in favour? Carried.
Toowoomba's council is trying to cut red tape and reduce fees and charges for subdivisions and medium density housing to try and bring on new housing supply.
We need to look at the impact of people not being able to come to the region because they can't find a house, or the doctor who wants to come here and work as a specialist, or the teachers or the nurses. And if they can't find housing, then that impacts on our economy. So it's just a domino effect all the way through our community.
CoreLogic's latest quarterly regional market report shows the first fall of almost 1% in regional housing values since the pandemic began. So-called lifestyle areas, such as the Richmond Tweed and Illawarra regions in New South Wales and Queensland's Gold and Sunshine Coasts, saw the biggest drops. Eliza Owen is CoreLogic's head of research.
The fact that high-end regional markets are starting to move into a downswing is a bit of a canary in the coal mine for the rest of the market.
That's not necessarily good news for renters.
We've continued to see increases of around 1% in the regional rent values through July, and not much of a easing in that growth rate happening either.
How unusual is this situation? Because usually when property values drop, so does the cost of rent.
Yeah, that's right. So property values and rents historically have moved together. So this is a really unique situation that we're in. And it's, I think, largely due to some of the unique demographic changes and constraints in the building industry that we've seen through the COVID period.
And Eliza Owen says with interest rates still rising and construction constrained, there's not much relief for renters in sight.
The Albanese government's continuing to prepare for a referendum on an Indigenous voice to Parliament. The Federal Minister for Indigenous Australians, Linda Burney, is meeting with her state and territory colleagues today to plan the pathway to that vote. Political reporter Dana Morse has the story.
It's been a couple of weeks since the Prime Minister stood on the lands of the Yolngu people and revealed his suggested referendum question to insert an Indigenous voice to Parliament in the Constitution. Now the Federal Minister for Indigenous Australians, Linda Burney, is organising what comes next.
I want to get a clear understanding from each state and territory where they're at with their treaty and truth-telling processes, and also talk about the referendum and hopefully get agreement of in-principle support.
But she expects her state and territory counterparts will have questions, particularly about the timeline for the referendum.
There may be those discussions, but the federal government doesn't have any timeline in mind at the moment. It's about getting an in-principle bipartisan support for the voice proposal from state and territories.
While the voice has been a key focus for the Albanese government, some states and territories already have truth and treaty processes underway.
The key issue is to make sure that we work hand in glove with state and territory processes and make sure that what we're doing federally fits in with what state and territories are doing and vice versa.
Legislation to establish a state treaty authority in Victoria passed the upper house last night.
There was a number of very excited and ecstatic members of community up there celebrating.
That's Victorian Minister for Treaty and First Peoples, Gabrielle Williams. She says the federal government could use the Victorian-based Yuruk Justice Commission as a blueprint for a national Makarrata or reconciliation process.
We see ourselves as the nation leaders in this space, certainly the trailblazers, and we think that there is a lot to learn from the process and the journey that we've been undertaking here now for a number of years.
Queensland yesterday announced a three-year truth-telling inquiry. The State Minister for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Partnerships is Craig Crawford.
It will start to generate some of the household conversations as people see things on the news, in the paper, on social media, of stories from their backyard that they may never have known.
And while Victoria and Queensland are on their own paths to treaty making, both state ministers think the federal government can still do its bit.
I do think there is a role there for the Commonwealth to play. I'd happily work with them, but I think we need to be careful that we're not duplicating, you know, some of these things at the same time. So timing, I think, is everything.
So I can certainly say I'm very excited to have a partner in the Commonwealth government now and to really look forward to those discussions that are going to take place tomorrow and beyond.
Gabrielle Williams, the Victorian Minister for Treaty and First Peoples, ending that report by Dana Morse. For the first time, the Australian War Memorial is trying to get an accurate count of the number of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander soldiers who served in the Vietnam War. It's a detail that wasn't recorded at the time. So far, there are 250 names on the list. James Viver reports.
On the 18th of August, 1966, the Battle of Long Tan was raging.
As we were firing, we got hit with a monsoon downfall, which really pelted down. And the gun pit was absolutely full of steam and smoke and spent cart cases.
John Burns was a bombardier providing life-saving covering fire for troops when his ammunition started to run dangerously low.
Out of the rubber trees came all these soldiers. They ran straight to the ammo dump and started collecting ammunition and bringing it to the guns. And that's when I felt so proud. We all wore the green skin. We were all there for each other. It was, what, 56 years ago? That memory is still as fresh in my mind as if it happened last week.
As an Aboriginal recruit, John Burns was treated equally in the army, not something he'd always experienced back home.
Getting on a trolley bus and the driver has a look straight at me and said, "We've got a black snake on the bus. I think he's frightening people." Now, for an 11-year-old boy, that really hurt.
John joined the army a year before conscription began.
Numbered marbles representing all of the birth dates applicable to the men covered by this ballot.
Although Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander men were exempt from national service, they were still required to present to a recruiting office if their number came up in the ballot.
17, February 17.
Correct.
Those adjudications by recruiters and enlisting officers was based on the colour of the skin.
Michael Bell is the Indigenous Liaison Officer at the War Memorial.
The darker the Aboriginal person was, the more chance he was to be offered an exemption from service. But what we're finding is that despite that, we have numerous examples of Aboriginal men responding to the call up for conscription, but then enlisting independently as civilians.
Extraction is planned to commence at 1800 hours tonight.
In the exhibition halls of the memorial, soldiers' experience of the Vietnam War is brought to life. Now the official history of the conflict will record the number of first Australians who served.
For a long time, these men have all known that they've served, but there's been no actual pointing to them as Aboriginal men.
The memorial now wants to hear from Indigenous veterans and their families, with the expectation that hundreds more names will be added to the list published today. Vietnam veteran John Burns doesn't regard his service as different to anyone else, but says publishing the list is still important.
I hope people will realise that Aboriginal men and women are always there, ready to make that sacrifice if called on to defend our country.
Vietnam veteran John Burns, ending that report by James Fiver. The Tasmanian tiger or thylacine hasn't been seen for nearly a century, but an Australian scientist's aiming to create a baby Tassie tiger within 10 years. Researchers believe they have the technology and now a new partnership with a US genetic engineering company to bring the extinct carnivorous marsupial back to life. Alexandra Humphreys prepared this report.
The thylacine, or the tiger as you'd call him, has been creating quite a lot of interest lately.
By the 1960s, thylacines were already long gone from Tasmania. But intrigue about the creature lingered, so much so that the state government made a short film about them.
Not a lot is known about him because when the thylacine was plentiful, settlers were generally interested in furthering their sheep growing. And as a killer, his extermination was of the utmost importance.
Once the largest carnivorous marsupial, the Tasmanian tiger was an apex predator that looked a bit like a dog. University of Melbourne Professor Andrew Pask is dedicated to bringing them back, and he says a new partnership with a US firm might be the breakthrough his team needs.
We're at a point in time now where we've got the technology at our fingertips to really do this. There's no technologies that we need to bring an animal back from extinction now that we don't already have in hand.
The researchers have relied on the hundreds of thylacine specimens kept in museums to piece together its genome from DNA.
The way that de-extinction science works is you have to look around in nature to find the closest living relative. In the case of the Tasmanian tiger, that's the fat-tailed dunnart. It's a small little carnivorous marsupial species about the size of a mouse.
They've also mapped the fat-tailed dunnart's genome. Now the scientists are making slight changes to dunnart cells to turn them into thylacine cells. Then a process like IVF will likely see a dunnart act as a surrogate for a thylacine joey.
Dunnarts and thylacines, although they're vastly different in size as an adult, they all give birth to babies that are not much bigger than the size of a grain of rice. So what that means is the challenges of growing that embryo either in the lab setting or in a surrogate mum is much less challenging for a marsupial than it is for something like a mammoth.
Professor Pask is hoping the first joey could be born within a decade.
The ultimate success of this project for us is not just being able to bring back the thylacine, but being able to put it back into that environment, being able to put it back into Tasmania. And that's because it was the only marsupial species that was an apex predator. And they play really critical roles in balancing the entire ecosystem that sit beneath them in those food chains.
The US biosciences firm Colossal is already working to bring back the woolly mammoth. Its chief executive Ben Lamb says the projects are about more than resurrecting lost species.
We think that's a technology that can be massively transformative, not just, you know, in bringing back thylacines and mammoths, but it could be really helpful in conservation aspects around the world.
Professor Pask says it's about righting a wrong of the past.
I think we owe it to some of the species that we aggressively exterminated to bring those animals back if we can.
Professor Andrew Pask from Melbourne University, ending that report from Alexandra Humphreys and Liz Gwynn. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. We've never heard anything like it before.
Prime Minister secretly appointing himself to multiple ministerial positions. That's what Scott Morrison did, and he hid it from us for years. Today, Radio National's breakfast host, Patricia Karvelas, on the former leader's strange power grab. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.